ready. Okay, everyone, if you could sit down, we're going to begin right now. I hope you've gotten all of your laughter out of your system because these two guys are not very funny. Two of the least funny people I know. Lino and Mark, are we ready to go? Let's do it.
You don't need an introduction. Exactly. Paul, this is a lot of fun to be able to have this conversation like in front of people. So Grace and Practice, 10 years ago, you wrote a book. Many people here have probably read it, or at least familiar with it, but some may not have. But it's sort of a summary of what the Christian faith, with a grace-infused sort of center, a monergism of one-way love at its center, what it looks like on the ground. Before we get into the contents, it's influenced to some degree by a guy named Frank Lake, who has written a great book, which is really great for strengthening your abs if you put it in your backpack, because it kind of, it balances you out in a system like that. But he talks about how archaeology, it doesn't necessarily determine our teleology, where we go from, doesn't always necessarily determine where we're going, but we need to understand it in order to figure out where we're going. So I wanted to do a little archaeological work with you, and just if you could just like narrate these pictures for me, just say a few words about, these are pictures from National Geographic. What's going on there?
Our focus in our life for 2 years was carnivorous plants. And my father started...
That's some 2 years.
I lost a leg as a result. But the my dad was actually the sort of founder of a new interest in carnivore flora. And the picture on the left is of my mother and dad and large quantities of carnivorous plants. And on the right, I'm with my sister in the Oregon coast, a scene from Ugetsu, the movie by Mizoguchi, carrying in something from the sea, evocative of eternity. The picture on the right...
No, now to the left. Here we go.
I think we also... Dad was a great specialist in poisonous mushrooms. And I'm there lancing...
It's a lot of dangerous plant life.
Well, we met people who were soon after wiped out by eating the wrong mushrooms. But in any event, I'm collecting mushrooms there in the state of Washington. And on the right, I'm overlooking a lake connected with mushrooms. And on the right, I'm in New Hampshire making interesting artistic recreations of mushroom interiors.
That's a lot of time with mushrooms.
Yes, my early childhood was imprinted with mushrooms.
Now, I want to ask you.
I feel like I'm sort of maybe Donald Trump and you're Megyn Kelly here.
It is. There we go. In a fresh rift, you say that, which is like a nerdy academic word for a bunch of essays saying your work is great from people that like you. You say that the sort of animating theme behind your work, and this is true in Grace and Practice, are under three headings: free will, not one-way love, and strength in weakness. Now, when I first met you, I actually brought not just some of your books, but this book by Frank Lake, which I love. Despite the way it looks, it's really practical reading, especially if you're in pastoral ministry. I mean, but I remember I lost this after you signed it. And I convinced myself that I left it at my friend Howard's house. And I was so certain in my mind, I convinced him of it too, and he told me he saw it there. I actually left it at a campus I was at also, but it's funny that like I was able to convince myself that he had it so convincingly that he believed it. And then it turned up later. Somebody said, is this yours from a lost and found? No, it's amazing, not just like that I was able to delude myself that I left it, but I was able to get him to buy into the delusion. You spend so much of your work in such a way, in such a penetrating way, revealing the myths we tell ourselves through some of these lenses, like free will, not one-way love and strength and weakness and how these things can penetrate the prisons of our own sort of delusions that we get bound in. So could you say, like, 10 years later, like, how you relate to these themes as they were teased out then and what it's like now? And is there anything... You say you in the Festschrift essay, you say you wouldn't want to... you would want to do things by sort of building on rather than attraction. So, like, how would you... If you were rewriting Grace in Practice, what would you do then?
Well, you're underlining three core existential pastoral experiences that have been proven largely true in the experience of my life and my ministry. And they're bitter, bitter truths. These are truths that are wrung out through misery and suffering and roadblocks and impasse. And the first one is that I want to believe that I have unconstrained freedom of action and agency, and come to find out I have very limited ability to choose the good. And Romans 7 is so existentially apt for every relationship and situation I've ever been in. So I hang very strongly with the folly of believing that we have free will. It's not a folly dogmatically, although it is dogmatic truth. It is a folly to believe it because your experience completely suborns it. Didn't we just hear that love is not rational? The power and the archaeological rooting of the sub-rational so over-informs my apparent freedom that I'm stunned by my ability to continually do the same awful or misguided event. Now, I have slightly altered the view. I do see, at this point, a little more room for human agency. Par exemple, seemed that the phrase which was given to me, even by Frank Lake, the phrase that when the student is ready, the teacher appears, when the student is ready, the teacher appears, seems to have some actuality in life. In other words, something about my vulnerability, usually created by disaster, seems to be something like an agency by which I am sort of ready to hear something that I wasn't ready to hear in my 20s or my 30s, but maybe in my 40s I'm ready to hear it. So I want to a little bit more go with Jesus's words that faith, like a mustard seed, can move mountains. There's something in there about a kind of readiness, usually brought about by repeated suffering and blows, hammer blows, that does seem to kind of work with God's desire to free me and to offer me himself, similar to what Nick Lannon was saying with extreme penetration in his breakout today. As far as one-way love, I see no option. I mean, it really doesn't matter whether I love her. I mean, it only matters whether she loves me. I mean, of course it matters objectively, but as far as I'm concerned, the only question is not how I feel about her. That's obvious. But does she feel that way about me? Love is entirely for the receiver to receive and for the giver to give. And I have no idea that there's some kind of perichoretic relationship between my and her love. I've got to feel loved for this thing to take off. And that's a religious statement that is rooted in a romantic reality. I wish it weren't true. A lot of these things I wish weren't true, Scott. I wish in many ways that Christianity weren't true, because it's rooted in the intransigence of human loss. I got an email the other day. I had written something about unmourned loss is the key block in the key paralyzing agent in psychological and emotional hope. Getting mastery or unmourned loss is the key rock in the road. And this person said, I don't understand. And I said, well, the tragedy of life is that we have these losses of a parent, of a loved one, of a lover, of a friend, of a child, and of a job, of a career path. And unless we mourn them, we are toast. And so the extreme accessibility to trouble that we have creates a situation in which one-way love is the sole powerful resolution. And finally, strength and weakness. Again, I'm a little nervous about baptizing all weakness, you know, because then it becomes a little lame. I mean, am I baptizing totally lameness? You know, is it, I mean, I have to be lame and uncool to be, is that strength? You know, I look at the people being interviewed, you know, by Eric's video. I mean, does anyone want to be like any of those people? And
the goddess guy was pretty cool, but.
Well, but we're supposed to say that they really are a theology of the cross, red merit, you know, buttons. And yet in Hinsicht, the German word for in retrospect, you see, as if I tell you that you'll only be strong when you're weak, that's a law and it's terrible. But if I tell you when you're weak, that's really the opening of strength, that in your humbledness and your shame, there is the seed of a true endurance, power, and love, then everybody knows that's true. So anyone here who's ever been caught in a real paralysis knows that there is ultimately only strength to be found in feeling the weakness and experiencing it.
I want to ask you a question. When you wrote the book Grace in Practice, the term one-way love caught on, and I think you were trying to say, look, we've got to take words that, it's like the Thornton Wilder quote, we need to find better persuasive words for defaced or degraded ones. And I found one-way love, so, you're a hashtag. I mean, it's on Twitter. So I'm wondering about imputation, because it's another word that it seems to be so important in what you've written, that when we, I mean, the only time people use it now is negatively, right? Why did you impute that motive to me? That's the only way you hear it in pop, but really, you know, you look at Les Miserables, that's the thrust behind a beautiful narrative like that. So could you come up with something that could become a hashtag for imputation?
That's a great question. Let me say how that works. It's like God has a pencil, and he's writing his love into your heart. And the pencil, however, attenuates, right? It's a sharpened pencil, and it's God's love. God, like the Pope's new book, the name of God is mercy. It's love and mercy. But then it gets thinner. It gets the point of the plow gets more and more, and it actually turns out that the way love actually works is imputation. Love, mercy, absolution, forgiveness. The point is getting narrower, but the actual graphite contact with my need is imputation. That's the agent, you know, in a drug. What is the active agent in a prescription? It's that, because what we are entirely convinced of is that we are rejects. That comes with being born. We are rejects. When we were first in New York, I got my picture in Guidepost magazine. And this picture was a double-page spread. It was a painting, and it won the Best Religious Painting Award for 1977. And it was a painting, a two-page painting of me on a New York subway. But they had to make it what they thought an Episcopal clergyman looked like. So I looked like, you know, very formal and traditional. And there was this anguished young woman, and we had had a contact on the Lexington Avenue subway. And she was a beautiful. She was an absolutely knockout, and she was a model. But she had a very severe drug habit, and she was getting worse and worse and worse. And she believed that she was actually ugly and horrible and dreadful and to be murdered. And I just, for some reason that I never understood, I treated her, I was told this later, in a chance encounter in a subway, as a lovely, aspiring, dear human person trying to find their way, waiting on table at night, like Eric was saying, and yet wanting to be famous. And it changed everything. I mean, it absolutely changed everything. And the thing that we're looking for, we want to be seen as lovely and as handsome and as dear and as intelligent and as bright. Most of those activities we only have inchoate. And when we're seen that way, it's always by a person, we actually become that. I mean, we used to see this at Grace Church, which is, this is the current Grace Church. In the 70s, what is happening at Calvary St. George's was happening at Grace Church. And we had this incredibly needy congregation of troubled, troubled people. And yet, as the time went on and the message of imputation, you might call it kind of cross-centered Joel Osteen. I don't mean that the way it sounds.
His recent book is Every Day Can Be Friday. I'm thinking Friday was a rough day for Jesus.
That's so very funny. That's very subtle. The day Christ died. But what I was going to say was that we would see, and we did impute to people, of all sorts of obvious problems. Over time, the rough places were made plain. Communion was very moving because people who had huge problems with obesity, for some completely unscripted and undisciplined way, sort of became thinner. And people who were beautiful in nature became beautiful cosmetically. And very sort of dorky persons, like in the video, became oddly self-assured. It was the most remarkable thing.
It's like the portrait of Dorian Gray in reverse.
That's also very subtle. And I want to say that that's what imputation does. Imputation is where the graphite of the pencil of God's love actually carves its message into the human red heart.
Something that you said, I've heard you say it numerous places, and it stuck with me. I remember the first time I heard it, I was watching a video, I remember it like it was yesterday. You were quoting Aldous Huxley saying that what the world needs is more theological psychologists or psychological theologians. I mean, Nietzsche is right about, like, at least descriptively, almost everything. He said that psychology would replace theology as queen of the sciences. Is this kind of how you understand your own, like, vocation now? Do you see yourself sort of in the vein of theological psychologists?
Yes, I think the greatest vocation, and many parish priests have it, some don't, many do, the greatest vocation that a pastor has is to be a religious psychologist. That is to say, someone who really is devoted to understanding the etiology of human pain in its real rootedness in the life of the emotion and the body-mind connection, and doing that from the standpoint of a theological grasp of what's really true and right about the transaction that alone creates the possibility of transformation, which is unmerited one-way love. And so we were fortunate. We got to know Frank Lake really well. I mean, here was a man who is a Freudian, an orthodox Freudian / object relations psychoanalyst who was also a charismatic Christian who is at the heart of the English charismatic renewal in the 70s and yet had us living out our birth traumas on the floor of the seminary. A guy was once living out his four-hour birth trauma with Dr. Lake, and this was a hotly evangelical, traditional Simeonite seminary in the Church of England, and a very famous bishop named Yanani Lovum was visiting, who later was murdered by Idi Amin, and this poor chap, a Baptist pastor, was screaming his heart out in the middle of a birth trauma, which sounds a little bit, you know, Marin County, and Yanani Lawum, the saint, opened the door, and this fellow was going, "Ah!" And Yanani Lawum said, "Oh," and closed the door. So, let me just say, the thing about Christianity or Christian care is required to be an integrated thing. And what I tried to do in that book is to present the hope of an integrated religion, an integrated experience of God. What characteristically happens And it's been referred to already by Dave and Sarah and Eric and also Ethan this morning, is that people tend to gravitate towards a religion, whatever it is, or a way of hope or healing, and yet they carry within themselves some compartment which is just too painful. It's just too painful. And so we often start well in Christianity because we've really heard a word of unconditional imputing love. But there does happen to be a wound in most people's lives that is unmentionable and unopenable. There is often in people's lives, of all sorts and conditions, some locked cabinet of pain that is simply too excruciating to go into. And it is possible, for example, to be a very devoted conscious and committed Christian, and yet to never visit the engine house of the pain of whatever has caused you initially to search it out. And at a certain point, you say to yourself, well, this is failing me. This is failing the thing that's really keeping me up at night. And so what a religious psychologist is able to hopefully help the person is to bring the message of God's grace into the deeply hidden drawer, and I've got one, and you've got one, and you may know somebody who has one, of ultimately the wheelhouse of the driving pain of your life. And unless that is dealt with, you'll be a disappointed Christian, or as Nick Lowe says, a failed Christian. On the other hand, of all the world religions, in my opinion, Christianity has the great medicine for the most extreme pain. I don't know about you today, but as I watched Rev, you know that little bit of Rev, two very large tears swept down my eye unexpectedly. I mean, I like to cry. You know, I like to cry. I'm very emotional. I am an emotional man, and I like to cry. And but I didn't expect to cry without giving it a little authorization, and I found myself crying. And secondly, when Ethan said, "Now this is integrated, psychologically rooted, accurate gospel," when Ethan said that Christ turns to you and says, I don't want to use the vulgarism he used. He said, yes, you are an A.H. But
very
I'm,
subtle as well.
But you are an A.H. Yes, you are an A.H., but I'm with you. I immediately felt better. There's something instantaneously in my own person felt better. I don't know if you had that experience, but that's the gospel.
Hmm.
When I'm loved in my AH-ness, which may be a different form than yours, but we share it, I literally felt better. So I felt that if people like Ethan and that movie and what we heard from Sarah last night were being preached from the pulpits of our churches, that there would be an unbelievable assimilation of negativity that would cause people to just come in to have that feeling that I've already had twice in less than 24 hours.
That's not the hashtag I was looking for, but I think that one's going to catch on. At lunch, as I was coming up here, I took a picture that I hope is going to become a Mockingbird book project. But so I saw you and Ted Peters talking, and I imagine this book title, Gorillas of Grace, by Paul Zoll and Ted Peters. Your son, David, was on a guy's radio show, Steve Brown, and some of you have heard this guy. And my wife and I were listening to an interview, and he said, and Steve Brown has this voice that's like, it doesn't register, it's so low. And she's like, I mean, David, I first found your daddy's work. Somebody gave me grace in practice. He said, this guy talks like you, but he says it better, and unlike you, he's relevant. He said, and he says, David, I mean, you guys preaching this grace, all the Pharisees in the church are going to kill you boys, you and your daddy. So now, there is some truth, right? I mean, because if churches find people like Ethan and Sarah to communicate the gospel, it doesn't often put you on. You don't win a lot of popularity contests in Ecclesial Digest. In fact, sometimes you have a great term that has stuck with me: zero sum ecclesiology. The church of modest expectations. So, yet you're a guy that says his prayers, is regularly in worship, and yet there seems to be some existential disconnect at the same time.
Well, I want to talk about that for a minute. That's a great thought. I want to say this in a way that isn't a downer to those of us who are attempting to bring some form of fresh hope and mercy into actual churches like this beautiful old church. And by the way, the gospel has been preached in this church since 1810. I mean, this is a place where the Bishop of New York told the rector that he should no longer have inductive Bible studies here in the church in 1810, that was against godly order. And Mr. Milner, the rector at the time, said, "Bishop, you may be right, but I want you to come down and tell the people that." The gospel has been preached in this particular edifice with extraordinary continuity for hundreds of years. But I would say that if you are looking for the church qua institutional church to reward or elevate this message that I at least have sought with Mary to give our lives to, you will be in for a rude awakening. Now, there are a number of people who disagree. I said that once at a Liberate conference, and Steve Brown said, "Oh, you make me want to kill myself." And I want to say, well, that is good insofar as the institutional church is concerned, because your hopes of elevation, your hopes of popularity and preferment are very likely to be completely stultified and brought low in terms of its reception. The institutional church will probably, if experience is any gauge, never accept it, and probably you'll end up in some form of absolute professional catastrophe, which was my experience personally, hopefully not yours. Mary and I were talking
about...
Don't
sugarcoat it. Let us be honest with the crowd.
We were talking about Sarah. I was saying, you know, Mary, if Sarah had a different message, she'd have a huge future in the church. And I said, "That's Sarah Condon." And then Mary said, "Oh, no. I think she'll be a huge success even with her message." And I said...
You're a sweet talker.
I said, well, I sure hope so. But I wanted to sort of say to Sarah, change your message because the world is extremely uncomfortable with one-way love. It is uncontrollable. It is... attacks all forms of pride. It is truly speaking truth to power. What people say is speaking truth to power is not speaking truth to power. Really speaking truth to power is bringing this message to people who are determined to suppress it. And it is a very dicey operation. So I have a low ecclesiology. I still go to church. The rector of our church likes us, thank God. And that's nice.
It is nice to be liked. There's a William Cowper hymn, "Love Constrained to Obedience." I think this is in some ways, it summarizes so much of what you've said and written and exchanges you have with people. "To see the law by Christ fulfilled and hear his pardoning voice changes a slave into a child and duty into choice." For many of us in this room, I mean, there's this concept like the butterfly effect, right? Like, you know, a butterfly flaps its wings and things change on another continent. I mean, you've been a sort of butterfly effect of grace. And for many of us, I kind of want to kind of finish where we began. Many of us, when they were like this gorilla, these are photos your dad took. This is a photo of a gorilla thirsty, just like dying of thirst. And for so many of us, when we've first encountered the words of grace you preached, this is how probably we felt. We're like a gorilla with parched throats. But there's another gorilla that I found a picture of that I think is what it looks like when you see and feel one-way love. And this is the gorilla your dad discovered, right? An albino gorilla. And here's a picture of him. And this to me is like an animal lover's portrait of the prodigal son. Here's the gorilla, his caregiver. And for so many of us, you know, an instrument doesn't create the music, but once you hear the music through that instrument, sometimes it's inevitably, it's forever bound. And for many of us, you're that instrument that has played the music that's brought us into the arms of our Father through his Son, Jesus Christ. And so for that, I think for the grace that you've borne witness to, I am eternally grateful.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Do I have 5 minutes to come?
We absolutely have 5 more minutes.
Thank you. Could I comment on that just for a minute? And that'll be the last thing I would say. Is that about right, Dave?
We're good.
Okay, great. Just, I want to say one thing. Now, my dad discovered the only albino gorilla ever. I mean, that's a great honor, right? He discovered the only albino gorilla ever found in the natural world in Spanish Guinea in about 1964. And it was later brought to the Barcelona Zoo and became their greatest attraction and recently died. You may have seen Son of Kong from 1935 with the sequel to the original King Kong. It also had an albino gorilla that did a Christian act of sacrifice at the end. So your parable is drawn from the natural world. Now... But I do want to say something a little bit about that hymn. If you want to find the authentic gospel as clearly and as succinctly ever stated in the history of the English language outside of, say, Cranmer and the King James translation, read the Olney hymns of William Cowper, as it's actually pronounced, spelled Cowper, because Cowper was a highly depressed, depressed man who spent much of his youth in the 18th century equivalent of an insane asylum, and was converted through the wonderful warden of the college of the insane asylum, and was a genius, and went on to produce some of the greatest hymns in our tradition. But Love Constraining to Obedience is probably in the top 2 or 3, and I want to talk about that just for a minute. You see, the thing about the gospel is that the whole purpose of life is to become more loving. And everybody knows this. Dave Mason says it's a big word in a small world. The Traffic singer Dave Mason in the 70s, it's the biggest word in a small word for a big world. And the whole purpose of living is to become, obviously, a loving person, to put the interests of someone else over yours. But it's impossible. It's absolutely impossible. And so what you tend to do, it's duty, right? You're constantly sort of keeping a kind of score. Even in my relationship with Mary, and I hate myself, when I pick it up in myself, I'll be saying, well, you know, I've cared for her when she was having such and such a medical issue or this issue. So now that I'm having my little medical issue, it's her turn to care for me, right? And one of the things that you find is that... in love is that true love is actually always engendered by someone's loving of you first, of the prior love. Remember Stevie Winwood, higher love, prior love. And this love somehow births beyond words a natural, huge, acute desire to do something for the other person. I mean, it's a small little thing, but the other night we were staying at a place where the heat is so hot that we're like prunes after 2 hours. You know, I feel like I'm in Andersonville prison camp, you know, or in Bridge on the River Kwai after staying in this hot, that dry heat. And I was just, and I suddenly had, this actually happened. I got up and I said to her, do you want a drink of water? Now that may not sound so obvious. What I would normally have done is I would have gotten the drink of water and said, oh, by the way, you want some? You know, or I might not have even done it at all because she's sleeping and maybe she doesn't know how thirsty she is. And
sometimes you want to be woken in the middle of the night to know how you're thirsty.
But
you are.
But it sounds so silly, but lame, but I actually had the emotional desire to sort of slightly jog her on the shoulder and say, do you need something to drink? And she did, and I did it. Now, that sounds like a terribly tiny thing, but I suddenly realized at that particular moment, I was taking an active interest in the interests of somebody else other than myself and without actual reference to myself. Now, that's a tiny little thing. Are you kidding? You know, I get into heaven on that basis, you know? But what was, what if, the thing about love is, it changes. Instead of duty and being a slave, it turns you into a child out of love. And anybody here who knows about love, and I'm believing that romantic love is the best index of understanding God's love. Let me repeat that. Romantic love between a man and a woman is the clearest bellwether, an anchored understanding of how God's love actually works. For some reason, equal to equal, that is the great engine house of understanding how God is. And when you actually wake up in the morning or at night and you suddenly say, I think I'd like to do this for that person, duty is gone and it's turned into choice. And that's really the heart of the gospel. And you'll know that you've understood it when you spontaneously want to do what somebody else wants simply because they want to do it. That's my little PS to the white gorilla.
Once again, thank you for who you are and for your work.
I'd like to invite those who are giving breakout sessions at both of the windows of breakout times, which have now been pushed back, as you know, by basically an hour or 45 minutes. But that was worth, I think both of those were worth going over time for. So this next one is going to, the first session is going to begin not at 2:15, but at 3 p.m., and the one after that is going to begin at 4 p.m. Now, I know that we're way past saturation, but hopefully you remember that everything's being taped except for Kleinenberg's presentation, which was just for you. Praise God. And but everything is being taped. But at the same time, there is no replication for face-to-face contact and interaction. So if you possibly summon it within yourself to stick around, you should. Okay, so this is the first slate of breakout sessions beginning at 3 p.m., breakout sessions A. Stephanie, why don't you come up here and tell us what you're doing and where you'll be.
I'll be here. And the title of my talk is Grace Stinks, which is especially appropriate as I'm just recovering from a stomach bug. So I'm going to be talking about some personal stories. I'm going to be selling my kid out, talking a lot about him, and just about Grace showing up in the messes of life.
Where will you be?
Here, right?
Yes.
Yeah, here.
That's your next C.J. Green, who will be in the Sunday school room, which is downstairs at the very end of the hallway.
Hey, guys. I'm C.J. Yeah, I'll be talking about the college admissions process and how that's like a parable of judgment in the modern day world. So I'll be in the Sunday school room talking about that and performancism. So.
DJ Jazz?
Do you all hate my brother as much as I do? I'm wearing a collar today in an attempt to legitimize what is by far the most trite of the breakout sessions offer. I'm going to be playing the weirdest Christian music that's ever been made. So if you're wondering what eschatological synth pop from 1983 in Sweden sounds like, this is your chance. Cosmic prog mass from Austria, 1979. This is your chance. And a bunch of other strange, cool experiments in the world of gospel salesmanship in the form of rap and disco. A song, and a 17-minute epic disco song called Simon Peter. Just retelling the denial three times. I'm not even going to play the other side, which is Judas Iscariot. Come downstairs if you want to hear some of that.
That'll be in the crypt where the Episco Disco is also happening. Now, next, the one and only Will McDavid, who will be in the chapel.
I'm Will. I'm going to be talking about eschatology, which is sort of the fancy word for the study of the end times. I have no idea what's going to happen or anything like that. Just don't want to give a bait and switch here, you know? But I'm going to hopefully try to talk about just a little bit of what that doctrine looks like, but more kind of how it, the role that it might play in sort of our more normal lives, sort of try to connect it a little bit to where we live. But yeah, down or upstairs, on this floor in the chapel.
Okay, so those begin at 3, and then at 4 p.m., this next slate will be happening, and the first one is what's called the most foolish job in the world, planting a grace-centered church.
Thanks, Dave. I'm Kurt. A couple years ago, The Economist magazine called the office of Archbishop of Canterbury the worst job in the world. But they were wrong, because planting a mercy, grace-centered church is actually the worst job in the world. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about how planting a grace-centered church can kill you. We're going to watch some Jim Carrey and listen to some Tame Impala as well. So love for you to join me.
Where is that?
That is in the sanctuary here.
My good friend Lauren Larkin is the next one on the docket.
I have spent all day trying to think of how I'm going to make my breakout session sound at all interesting for any of you to come to. I am speaking about grief and fear in the face of death, and I'm in the crypt, and that makes sense. So the crypt is going to be super fun for an hour, and then you're going to want to go to cocktail hour immediately after I'm done with you. So join me, and I do promise I have a good word. I do have one good word.
Awesome. Next, Raleigh Sadler.
Right after I moved to New York, I set about just meeting new people. And one of the first questions you're either asked or you ask people is, what do you do? And so I met a new person, and she said, what do you do? And I said, well, I fight human trafficking. Immediately she walks away. And there is a reason, because when we bring up justice and mercy, we're bringing up law. And law on its best day is exhausting. And so in my breakout in the chapel, we'll be talking about how to go from law to grace and how to allow, really, how to rest in the gospel to the point that it produces justice and mercy.
Where will that? And that will be in the chapel. That will be in the chapel at 4 o'clock. Last but not very much not least, my wonderful friend, Dr. Javier Garcia.
Hi, everyone. I'm technically not a doctor yet because I have to have it conferred on me like justification at my graduation. And PhD really just means pretty horrible decision. So if you want to have as many neuroses as I do, just try one. Apropos, so Dietrich Bonhoeffer, is he a boogeyman? Is he giving us relief, or is he actually giving us more law? Many of you have probably heard of him, if not in the previous talk, then just in the popular media as a very famous member of the resistance during the Second World War. You've probably also heard of Costly Grace, and that's probably terrified you. So I am going to talk a little bit more about it, and you know, maybe there's going to be a riot in the Sunday school room, but hopefully it'll be fun. So like we saw in those videos. At 4 p.m., Sunday school room, Costly Grace.
And then we're back here at 7-ish for Derek Webb to play. And if you've never heard this man play, it's going to be wonderful. So hope you're having a great time, and hope you also feel free to take a breather. Thanks for being here. We'll see you soon.